Can you believe we have actually done this podcast for a year?
On the one hand, Kathy, it feels like it's something we've been doing for a while. And on the other hand, it's just like a blink of an eye. And here we are, 12 episodes in.
12 episodes for sure. And a whole bunch of ideas for what might happen next. And our fabulous producer, Sadie, came up with this idea of interviewing us and asking us a little bit about the podcast, what we're thinking of for the future, and, you know, reflecting a little bit about where we've been.
It was a total plot twist, and we got an opportunity to answer questions that Sadie put to us. It was quite something, and I think we're going to be better interviewers as a result.
One can hope. And of course, we can't talk about our anniversary without acknowledging the amazing music that we have the privilege of using that's affiliated with our podcast, composed and performed and recorded by the fabulous Sarah McInnes.
So wonderful, because what we get to do is get to talk with Sarah about the work that she did for us, which we get to hear every month, and also hear about what she's been up to and the things that she does with the Legacy Project. So exciting to hear about what is making her create music in the spaces of dying, death, and loss. So such a privilege to get to hear from her and to really have the opportunity to thank all of our listeners for leaning in for an entire year and to ask them to stick with us and see where we get to go in the months to come.
Yes, because we do have some great things planned. We're going to probably talk a little bit about that with Sadie. But again, if you have any questions, comments, feedback, guest ideas for our podcast, please don't hesitate to reach out to us. And actually, we're going to sweeten the deal a bit, aren't we, Carrie Lynn? Let's have a contest. If a listener out there comes up with somebody new that we should talk to and reaches out to us on our Disrupting Death email or on Facebook or on Instagram, wherever you can find us on your socials.
On the form on the website, that would be a great place to contact us too.
We will do a draw and we will give a book away, and a book written by one of the people that we've interviewed. So it could be Sandra Martin's A Good Death. It could be the great book that Dr. Stephanie Green has written. It might be Chelsea Peddle. It could be The Many Faces of Maid that Cynthia Clark has been involved with editing.
I think that's a fantastic idea. You know how much I love a good giveaway.
So, listeners, let us know what you think of the podcast or suggest a new guest, and we'll put your name in a draw to win one of those four books.
Let's get these conversations started. Hello, and welcome to Disrupting Death. Perhaps, first off, I can ask you to introduce yourself to our listeners, please.
Sure. So my name is Sarah McInnes. I live out in Port Williams, Nova Scotia, but I'm originally from Peterborough, Ontario, and I work as a music therapist, an end-of-life doula, and a songwriter.
Amazing, Sarah. When Carrie Lynn and I were thinking about our podcast, Disrupting Death, it was essential to us, like from the onset, how important music was going to be as part of it. So we're so grateful that you were willing to create and record the music that we use. Had you done something like this before? What was the process like for you?
No, I had never created music for podcasts before. I'm also very particular when I listen to podcasts. I think in my process of creating it, when I was speaking with you, Carrie Lynn, and Kathy about what you were looking for, you gave me some key words to go with, like, you know, not too happy, but not sad. And it's kind of fun as a musician to take words and then translate that into something audible. I know that we had talked about a phrase or a sentence or something being used. So I took some time to think about that. And so the words, how did we get here and how your story means everything now, I think is really fitting for this podcast, because I think when we're faced with situations like our loved ones dying or choosing maid, for example, it's almost like, how did we get here? Like, you know, it can be really surreal. And I think that's where the meaning making comes in, which is what I like to focus on in my own musical projects. And so that's where that phrase came from. And it fit together and you guys liked it. Thank goodness.
We sure did. And one of the things I really appreciate about the music that you created for us was that you got it. Like, you kind of get the fluidity of the process of moving from living until you die and then grief at the end. And also how that can feel like that idea of not being overly sad, not being overly dramatic. It's a part of life. And so how did you get to that? How do you know that?
I feel like it's probably a lifetime I've been and will continue to work on understanding that death isn't necessarily an ending, but it is a transition. And I don't know, like when I choose words for songs and like for this podcast, when I thought about that line, I have like an inner understanding of like, it just sits right. Like it's literally, it's a feeling. It's just like, oh, that's it. There's always this intuitive understanding of like, okay, you can stop now. Stop now. Don't add anything else. Don't change it. It's good as it is. Before you let your sort of cognitive brain come in and maybe reason why all the reasons why it might not be good, you have this feeling of, yes, that's it. And then you just have to go with it. So I think I probably sent that to you like in that period of time where I was like, I think that's right. And if it's not, they'll let me know and I'll workshop it from there.
I love that. That idea of intuitively knowing and understanding. I get this sense from you, and I'm thinking of you, the human, the artist, the music therapist, the death doula. How did you become what Carrie Lynn sometimes referred to as a deathy? How are you somebody who recognizes the value of dying and death as part of life and living and translates that musically?
Honestly, I think a lot of my exploration of death and being a deathy or a death worker, whatever you want to call it, has actually come from my own searching for like, what does it all mean? You know, that question, but also it also comes from a lot of my own fears and wanting to understand processes of dying and grief and how people move through the hardest parts of life. I can go all the way back to childhood. I grew up in the Catholic Church. I went to a lot of open casket funerals. I had no one explaining to me anything about what dying meant or where do people go. I was being invited to accompany adults up to caskets and seeing them touch a dead person's body and just not getting it and then becoming incredibly fearful of, oh, that person is old. My grandma's old. Therefore, that's going to be her someday, or like transferring that onto my parents too. So I think I developed a lot of anxiety around death. And then when my grandmother did die and I was moving through that process of grief for the first time with someone really close to me, I was also living away from home. So I didn't have a community of people who understood what I was going through. I didn't have that community to lean on because I think grieving in community is so important. And so when I was out here and grieving her death, and then shortly after that, the pandemic happened. And then there's all types of grief that came up through the pandemic, not just death related. And it was then in that space of isolation and still pretty actively grieving that I started pursuing work in that space.
So when you talk about exploring work in that space, what are you doing in that space these days?
I'm doing quite a bit, I think. During COVID, that's when I started the Legacy Song Project. So I started that in 2021. And the Legacy Song Project is where I interview people at end of life or people who have lost loved ones. And then I write and record a personal song for them based on the stories that I hear. And since starting that project, I've been able to write songs for people all over Canada because I'm able to do it online as well as in person. And so I've been working in that regard, as well as recently I started working as a music therapist part-time at a local hospice. So there's that piece of it now as well. I don't think I ever would have, 25-year-old me would have never have said like, this is what you're going to be doing in your early 30s. But here I am trusting the process. And yeah, that's just kind of where things are at right now.
Wow. There's so much there, Sarah, that I'd like to ask you to elaborate upon. And I want to follow you and hold your hand and see all the things that you do in your day. One thing that really resonated in what you just shared, and thank you for sharing about your childhood, because I do some work with grief and with littles. And one of the things that I have learned over the years is that no inclusion or exclusion without explanation. So you describing this whole idea of here are these rituals we do, but I'm not necessarily going to let you know why we do them or what those are going to look like or if you have any big feelings, you know, you have an out, etc. So much there to really, we learn so much about the things that we experience. So you've mentioned the Legacy Song Project, Atlantic Chapter. And I kind of would like to do a little bit of a segue into involving your recent film festival, Reframe. And one of the takeaways I have is that because grief is unique to the individual, your project has involved people who are grieving the death of their child, but also people who are grieving because they are anticipating their own death. Perhaps you could talk to us and to our listeners a little bit about the song project and how that kind of morphed into what ultimately became an incredibly poignant and impactful documentary.
Sure. Yeah. So when I started the Legacy Song Project, I was writing songs for free for people initially because I just wanted to see what that process was like. Could I do it? And that over time evolved into me taking commissions. And I realized I'm very much about wanting to make things accessible for people, especially around grief and dying. I know they always say that dying is an expensive thing. So for when I was trying to find participants who'd be interested in having a song written, I didn't want price to be a barrier. So part of the inspiration to create the Atlantic Chapter, which I call it a sub-branch of the wider Legacy Song Project, is that it was a hyper-focused project just in the Atlantic region involving all four provinces. And the original idea was to have four people at end of life, four people who had lost loved ones with representation from all four Atlantic provinces. And really, when I was writing the grant proposal for this, I was thinking of like, this way that I could get funding so that people who are participating don't have to pay for it. And it would also be a way for more people to learn about what I'm doing so that word gets out about the project itself. There was so much that fell into place with this. Like, I think it was 3 days before I submitted the grant proposal, I ran into my friends at the bar. And one of them is a filmmaker. And I told her about what I was doing. Her name's Allie Kelly. And her partner, Pat Lapointe-Van, were the two filmmakers involved in the project. And Allie said to me, well, you should just apply for a grant for a film. Like, let's make a film with this too. And I was very hesitant originally because I wasn't sure that people in this time of life, whether it was actively grieving someone or someone who is themselves approaching the end of their life, I had no idea if they would be open to actually allowing our interviews to be filmed. So my initial reaction was like, I don't know if this is a good idea. And she said, it doesn't matter. Like, if you get the funding, you can decide then if you want it to be filmed. So when we did get the funding, I was like, okay, Allie and Pat, this is a go. And, you know, ironically, or perhaps synchronicitously, if that's a word, Allie was pregnant at the time. And so at the time that we were starting to do the interviews for this project, Allie had a child. And so it was this really interesting, like he kind of grew up alongside this project, which was all about death and grief. And here he was, this little representation of new life, which is like really cool. And so we ended up finding these participants mostly through word of mouth and social media. These participants had a great variety of story for us to delve into, and we interviewed them. So each participant that I interviewed, I wrote a song for them based on the stories that they told me. And then once that was all said and done, we recorded the album, we toured the project. So we actually took the stories and the film and a live performance back to the communities that the stories came from, which I thought was really important. So we started in Wolfville, and then we went to Halifax, and then over to Moncton, and then we went to Newfoundland, and then ended in Prince Edward Island. And following that, that's when we started entering it into some film festivals. And being from Peterborough, it was very cool that we got into the Reframe Film Festival, which just happened at the end of January. And so I got to also take that film home and then show my family and friends what I'd been up to, and then also introduce it to an entirely new crowd of people. And so the presentation, it's always been that we show the film, which is like a 33-minute documentary. And then following that, I would live perform some of the songs and kind of elaborate on the stories that you would have heard in the documentary. It's a really neat way to bridge that gap of a challenging topic for audiences that are willing to show up to the show.
The audience and the participants, And you and the musicians who've all shown up to recognize that how people die matters, and also the experiences of grief. And I think art, well, I know actually, art, be it music, be it literature, be it artwork of photography, can be a real bridge for that for people. And you articulate that so well. And I'm wondering, what kind of feedback have you heard from people about your film, about the Legacy Project?
I've gotten such wonderful feedback from people. I think people are quite moved by the intimate nature of the documentary, like the fact that we were allowed to film such personal conversations and experiences. I've had people speak to me about the importance of the platform we've given for space and talking about death by suicide, because one of the participants died by suicide. And so we have a segment of the film that speaks to the way that we talk about suicide, because the mother of that person that died is a very strong advocate for the language that we use. So giving her a platform to be able to speak to audiences through film was really special. I think something I wasn't expecting was several people at different shows commenting on how nice it was to be in a space where grief was invited into the room and wasn't asked to stay outside. I had several people say to me that that community aspect of being in a space where people were there for something that was bigger than themselves and doing that with other people, it felt really important to them.
And I love that image, inviting grief in instead of asking it to stay outside. I think that is so important when we think about normalizing and socializing dying, death, loss, and grief, that we need to make those spaces that have creativity in there, that recognize that we can have all the feels within the context of watching a documentary and giving witness to music that would have been created as part of your legacy project. I think that is a wonderful catalyst, and one that I would say that healthcare struggles with, you know, trying to sort of, Sarah's looking at me like, no shit, Sherlock. Yeah, yes, we know this. I'm stating the obvious. Let's be honest here. Healthcare struggles with that. Politicians also sometimes struggle with that. So we're dealing with social policy. We're dealing with care for people. And so we need that art, that humanness of connection. And so I got to ask, Sarah, does your work also include people who are using MAID at the end of their lives?
It could involve people. I've not written a song yet for a person that they themselves are receiving MAID. I have written songs for people whose loved ones have received MAID. So I have had conversations with folks about like their feelings about that and, you know, the knowing the time and like the anxiety that can create, but also the space that I can give for people to be super intentional about saying goodbye to their loved ones and gathering. So I haven't yet written a song for someone who has received MAID, but certainly seen and observed some things in the work that I'm doing.
Well, I wanted to give a bit of a shout out to another filmmaker, Steen Starr, with whom I know you shared the stage at the Reframe Festival. And I kind of want to circle back to Kathy's question about MAID and the role that MAID might play in all of the incredible work that you do. And I know that Steen has been involved in making films that really combat stigma. Older Than What was the title of one of their films. Do you have any thoughts on things that you've understood or observed or felt regarding the issue of stigma around medical assistance and dying?
Yes. Yeah. So in the facility that I work in now, MAID happens probably on a weekly basis. So I've never been present while someone has been receiving MAID, but I've been certainly in the building. I can appreciate the agency it gives people. I've seen that part of it, where people are like, I'm making this decision. This is what I want. I'm done here. I've seen the anxiety that it gives people who are going to receive it, where they just kind of want it to be now. It's like I've seen people push their assessments up because they want it faster, because the waiting is, you know, they always say the waiting is sometimes worse, just in many things. And I'm sure for something like MAID, there could be some anxiety there. And I've also seen where family members have gotten involved with conflicting opinions, often influenced by religion. And I've seen people talked out of receiving MAID and then dying probably not the best death, because they didn't have that choice, or their family members might have taken that away from them or talked them out of it. So like, I've seen a lot in that regard, and that I find personally the most challenging, because I just personally disagree with that so much. And then in the workplace where I'm, that's not my role to talk to people about making decisions around MAID. So often I've become like a listener. I've listened to a lot of family members speak to me about how difficult it is to know that their loved one wants to choose MAID, and therefore, because of their religious beliefs, they might be going to hell. And like, that's really hard to hear when that person is in pain and is trying to choose something for themselves. And the third thing I wanted to speak about was the most recent policy around MAID for people with mental health challenges was just tabled again, right? Like for 3 years or so, postponed for 3 years. And I have a close friend who would really like that as an option, who struggles with mental health. And that personally has been challenging to what I would want for her. And then also understanding that she is her own person who wants to make her own choice. And so seeing that play out in real time of like, oh, here's a policy that might actually affect someone I know and love. And then having that tabled, and then kind of feeling that for her of like, oh, that's another 3 years of her maybe needing to wait if she doesn't want to be here anymore. And how that also sucks. Like, there's, it kind of sucks on both ends. So yeah, there's so much to unpack. And because it's still such a new service, I also know when my friend who received MAID, she was like, did you know that it costs a lot of money to get your body taken from your house to the hospital? And I'm like, they don't account for that in the service? She's like, no. And I'm like, well, that's big oversight. You know, I have a friend who's from Europe, and medical assistants dying over there will account for those things, because ultimately they're like, well, it's cheaper for you to do this than to be in the hospital for like 2 years in palliative care. So like, why don't we just also support the getting the body to the funeral home afterwards, or getting the body to the morgue, or wherever it needs to go? So MAID in Canada, it's still a work in progress, I think.
Absolutely. And Sarah, you have just articulated so well why your music and you have been such a good fit for our podcast, because those points that you made, and I suspect there were a few more things within that, are things that we're wrestling with too, and hoping that people who listen to our podcast are also working through or thinking about or asking those questions. And as you were speaking, I was like, okay, we're talking with you as our 1 year anniversary, and I don't think we've managed to touch on most of those things that you brought up yet. But I think you're right. MAID is a work in progress. I think it is something that as Canadians, we need to be more aware of and need to work towards improving on a social policy level or a legislative level, but also really what's happening in the moment. And I think music can really be a part of that. And so I'm going to put you on the spot in closing, Sarah, if I haven't done that enough already. Can you prescribe a song for our listeners? Just, I know, big, okay? And just kind of an off the cuff, if you were to give people a song to listen to that might help them spend some time thinking about what matters to them at the end of life. Is there one that comes to mind?
Yes, there is one that comes to mind. So it's by one of my favorite Canadian singer-songwriters, Sarah Sleen. I love her music. I love her vibe so much. I believe it's called Cosmic Ballet. There's one line in there that's like, I think it's like, sick woman in a sick bed waiting, light fast fading in her eyes. And then there's somewhere else, another light is falling, turning into newborn cries, like something like that. And I'm just like, the expansiveness of that song, like you listen to it, there's like a full orchestral arrangement. It's beautiful. And I feel like it really captures a lot of like the bigness of living and dying.
Wow. Sarah Sleen. I mean, I loved you before, but I have large love now. I've seen her live a couple of times. And I have a funeral playlist, and her song, The Rose, is on my playlist because, yes, as a lyricist, Sarah has an incredible ability to cover so much ground. And then those orchestral, oh, just amazing.
I want to say thank you, Sarah, for being of service to our podcast, for creating the amazing music that welcomes our listeners into our conversations and then sends them on their way, and for taking a chance on us before we launched, you know, two strangers who reached out and said, hey, we need some music, and for answering our call. And Sarah, you are phenomenal to work with, and thanks for today's conversation.
Thank you both so much for having me here, and congratulations on your year of this podcast being in the world. It's a huge deal.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Caroline and Kathy.
Hi, this is Sadie Mallon, the editor of the podcast. I so enjoyed that interview with Sarah. She's phenomenal. Now we're going to have a different kind of interview. I'm going to be interviewing the co-hosts, Kathy and Carrie. All right, Kathy and Carrie. So before we dive in, can we give the listeners a chance to get to know the both of you a little bit more? So beyond co-hosting this fabulous podcast, what do each of you do for work and play?
Sadie, thank you so much for agreeing to do this. And actually, let's be honest, this was kind of your idea to interview us around the 1 year mark of the podcast and to reflect on kind of where we've been and where we're hoping to go, because we're not done at 12 episodes. So outside of doing a podcast, I am an associate professor in the School of Social Work. And in full transparency, I got to meet the fabulous Sadie as our producer because she was an MSW student with me. We got to spend a year and a half together, and it turned out she not only is going to be an incredible social worker, which she's already working as, but she also has a multitude of skills, including artistic skills and an ability, who knew, to edit a podcast and not laugh too hard at Caroline and myself when we're flubbing our way through this. So that's how I got to meet Sadie. That's also my salary job. And of course, being an academic, I get to do research as part of my work. And I am also the director of the Center for Education and Research on Aging and Health at Lake Kidd University in Thunder Bay, which is on the traditional lands of the Fort William First Nation, signatory to the Robinson Treaty of 1850. And I love living in Thunder Bay and having access to the outdoors and things that I do outside of work. Some days it feels like all I do is work, but I really generally like most parts of my job an awful lot. But I like to play outside. I have a large dog that I get to spend lots of time with. Her name is Lucy Maud. Yes, as in the author, Lucy Maud Montgomery. And yeah, that's kind of me. Carrie.
Well, outside of the podcast, I am research project lead on the research that Kathy organizes. So I get to do that. And I used to be a student researcher, but of course I completed my doctorate with the help of Dr. Cordes Miller. And here I am now, the project lead. So that's at LU. That's my only attachment to Thunder Bay at the moment. In my other job, I have the privilege of teaching French immersion at an elementary school here in South Bruce Peninsula in Ontario, which I absolutely love. I've only been at it a week, but it's lots of fun and I get to speak French. I live on the Bruce Peninsula with my beautiful partner and we love to ski, although we were robbed of a ski season this year.
Yep, definitely not much of a ski season this year, that's for sure. So could you both please give us an elevator pitch about how you found yourself immersed in the field of death and dying, and perhaps more specifically, how did that journey lead to the unique role of, you know, co-hosting a podcast about MAID?
So it's interesting to kind of think about how we got here. And I would say it's because for me, it's been really important that we have conversations about end of life. And to the point where I wrote a book in 2018 called Talking About Death Won't Kill You. Really wanting to bring conversations about dying, death, loss, and grief out of the closet and to normalize and socialize them. And then this podcast is part of a larger research project, which we started a couple of years ago, but was continuation from a previous one where we learned that just as people are struggling to talk about dying, death, loss, and grief,
People were also not talking a whole bunch about medical assistance in dying in a way that might serve people to, again, to normalize the experiences of accessing medical assistance in dying in a way that might help to destigmatize the process. Because when we did our first research project, we heard pretty loud and clear from people that they weren't wanting to be overly open about their person having access made. They were not unprepared, but they were grieving the death of someone that they loved. They had gone through a process often of lengthy caregiving, which had been challenging and often rewarding. Their person had died, and then to have to hold space for other people's reaction to the fact that their person had used medical assistance in dying, which at the time was still relatively new, was a lot for people. And so when Carrie Lynn and I and our other research team at the time hosted a research symposium, Carrie Lynn, you can let me know if you didn't feel this way. I was surprised at sort of the misinformation out there around medical assistance in dying and that sort of the lack of general understanding in populations. And so I've always been somebody who thinks that we need to build capacity in community, and we do that through education, and we do that through having conversations. And I feel that as somebody who is in a privileged position in academia, which very much is, that it's my job and my role to be out there and having conversations with communities. And a podcast is a really cool way to do that.
I love that. Podcasts are so accessible. I actually think one of our very first conversations, when I was asking you to take me on as a student, I was asking you, what are your favorite podcasts about death and dying? And lo and behold, here we are.
That's so true. I remember. Yeah.
Okay, Carrie, what brought you to death and dying?
Yeah, thank you. It's a lovely question because it explains how I actually found Kathy Cordes Miller. I was a PhD student at Lakehead. As an educator, I was returning to do a doctorate so I could use theater to affect change within schools. A lot of my colleagues were talking about how they felt ill-prepared to teach certain subjects like drama in elementary schools. And I thought, I know, I'll go in and I'll work as a teacher educator, educating other teachers. And I started volunteering at Thunder Bay Regional Health Sciences Center with my lovely puppet Phoebe. And I was bouncing around the halls of the hospital and I got asked to visit a palliative care patient. And I went over the threshold of that room and I thought, this is where I want to be. This is the work that I want to be involved in. I want to learn more about this. So I Googled TED Talks, and I wasn't a big watcher of TED Talks, but I Googled, you know, TED Talks death, TED Talks dying, and up pops Dr. Kathy Cordes Miller, and she does her 15, 16 minute talk about dying, death, and loss. And it says Kanata, which is a city, a part of Ottawa, our nation's capital. And I thought, oh my God, this is my person. And she's obviously a professor at Carleton or Ottawa U. Lo and behold, I Google her and she's across the campus. I leg it across the campus and I bang on her door in the School of Social Work. I'm a faculty of education person. And I say, I don't know what this all means, but I watched your TED Talk and I work at the hospital and I have this puppet and I think I want you to be my person. And I don't remember exactly, but Kathy said, I don't really know what you're talking about, but please come in. And then we kind of took it from there. So that I knew that she was my person. I knew that I wanted to dwell in those spaces with the theater background that I had. And I totally agree with what Kathy was saying just now, because as an educator, I'm always thinking about literacy. And the literacy piece right from the get-go was my understanding was that we were dying illiterate as a society, we're death illiterate, we're grief illiterate, and of course, we're made illiterate in a lot of respects. And while MAID won't happen for everybody in Canada, it's an option for every Canadian. So I loved when Kathy said, here's the research that I want to embark upon, because people need to have these conversations because these are big life decisions. And I want to understand how people are doing in these spaces. And so here I am alongside and enjoying every minute of the ride.
Beautiful. Okay, so this next question, I was thinking about how the two of you have been so embedded, you know, in the world of death and dying for so long. But I'm curious how hosting Disrupting Death has potentially influenced or changed your personal perspective on MAID and the broader conversations surrounding end-of-life care.
Ooh, another good question, Sadie. I think, or at least I went into the creation of the podcast because I wanted to spend some time thinking about medical assistance in dying. And as somebody who worked in hospice palliative care for many years before becoming a researcher within the MAID space, I struggled with parts of medical assistance in dying. Not that whether or not I think people should have choice and autonomy at the end of life, that was always really clear for me. I think just as at the beginning of life, women should have autonomy over their bodies and the ability to choose, I think we should also have that at the end of life. So that wasn't a big stretch for me. But I wanted to hear more about, like, what did that look like in different populations, people who I didn't think would be able to easily access MAID in a straightforward way. And like I said, I'm from Thunder Bay. So I know that here in Northwestern Ontario, we sometimes struggle with having access to palliative care. As Andre Picard has said, and I have said numerous times, that access to palliative care in Canada continues to be a postal code lottery. I struggled with the idea that we didn't legislate palliative care, but we've legislated MAID, that we have had different discourses occurring around medical assistance in dying than we did in terms of supporting palliative care as an option. And both Carrie Lynn and I talked probably ad nauseum, if we're going to be honest, about this idea of true choice at the end of life. And that's very much what I support, is I want people to be able to have access to a palliative approach to care and to be able to access MAID. I want Canadians to have it all because I think we deserve that. So I wouldn't say it changed my thoughts around broader conversations around end of life. I think it has really reinforced for me that we need to have these conversations. And I would say, as much as I enjoy podcasting and, you know, the fact that we managed to push one out once a month, I think we also still need, and this was also reinforced to me as well, to have these conversations in community. And so in conjunction recently with Hospice Northwest, our center, the Center for Education and Research on Aging and Health, hosted a panel for the people of Thunder Bay, where people could come out and hear a story of somebody who'd accompanied someone who used MAID at the end of life, hear from a MAID coordinator, and also hear from a physician who is a MAID provider. And I figured we'd probably get, you know, 30, 50 people. We were well over 100. And literally the conversation went for over 2 hours and people wanted more. And so we need to, and I'd say this has been reinforced for me since having the podcast, that we need to think about making sure we have a variety of different opportunities for people to get information.
And Carrie, how about you?
So mine is going to be much more introspective, because I think, as with a lot of things that I think I know about, I think my views about MAID were perhaps much more clear-cut at the beginning of our time together, whereas the more we peel away the layers of the onion that is medical assistance in dying, the more opportunity I have with Kathy to ask questions of our guests and really think about what they're contributing to the national conversation and kind of apply those things to my own thinking. The more I really start to look at my own thoughts, I really feel like what the podcast is doing for me is making me, along the lines of what Kathy said, that issue of true choice, what it's making me is really hone in on where I feel I sit on a lot of things in terms of the legislation itself. And so what it's asked me to do is move out of that kind of easy fit of saying, yes, I you know, full stop, I am supportive of the legislation. What it's been able to do for me in terms of the podcast itself is being able to look at and say, well, hang on a minute. You know, I feel this way about this and I want to know more about that before I kind of land on something finite in terms of my take on it. I completely uphold what Kathy said about the issue of true choice and informed choice. And that being said, I'm taking a piece of our own advice and having a look at things and saying, yeah, you know, how do I feel about it? Or what does that mean? And now that legislation has been, you know, kicked into the future to 2027, will that give us space now to really pick apart the nuances of this evolving legislation? So I'm grateful for the space to do that because it's allowed me to just be much more present with how I feel about things rather than kind of I've made my line in the sand and this is where I stand.
I love those answers. And I have to say, one of my favorite things about our podcast is how nuanced it is, how we aren't pushing any one agenda. We're here to listen. And I think the more you listen, the more you realize that everything is many shades of gray. There's no white, there's no black. It's also complex. And Carrie Lynn, like you said, kind of the more you peel back this onion, you think you're going to get an answer, and it sometimes just gets more complicated. I know I myself, my personal journey with, you know, thinking about MAID and researching MAID, and I feel like I've swung from one direction to the other direction, and now I'm firmly in the middle, and I'm just here to listen. And yeah, it's been an interesting journey.
I think it should be an interesting journey. And I think if we are doing our job well, that we are going along that journey with listeners because we're constantly learning. And people will always say, well, do you think you're going to have MAID at the end of your life? Asking it. And I'm somebody who's, as I've disclosed numerous times in this podcast, I've had cancer. I live, you know, with a chronic illness. And so it is something that I think about all the time. And I can say I honestly don't know at this point. But do I want it as an available option for me? Absolutely. That I do know. So who knows? And so we can journey along. And I love the idea that medical assistance in dying provides us with options. And at the time of death, people are asked, do you consent to this at this point? And we have heard from participants in our research study who said that they've pressed pause or come back to it later or changed the date because they wanted to wait for people to arrive, all those kind of things, because they have options at the end of life. And I think one of the things the three of us can all agree on is that we want people to have options and opportunity and to also have done the work of having the conversations to know what's going to be available to them and how to access.
Yes. So, you know, as we're having these discussions, they're not always the most comfortable discussions. Was there an interview or a moment that challenged you this past year or just pushed you out of your comfort zone? I see Kathy is a little head nod.
For sure. I would say most of the interviews have pushed me out of my comfort zone. How about you, Carrie?
I know two stand out in particular for me, our interview with Rose Binley, and thinking about the role that medical assistance in dying would play in a society where people don't have access to basic supports. So absolutely. I think I really, as a left of center, we take care of our people, common good, community support oriented person. I think it was uncomfortable to realize that in my privileged space of being a person with a body that does not require specific supports, that I really don't know what I don't know. And so that was a good reminder that I need to get out of my own experience a lot more.
I love that. And I think it's that listening piece. And if you were to change your question, Sadie, and ask who did we need to listen to more from, I would say we need to hear more from people who are living with disabilities. I think that is a whole area. And that is a challenging conversation for me as well. I think hearing Rose talk about her children and some of the struggles and that idea, that piece that really hits hard with me is around the parenting piece. So hearing Rose's struggle in terms of wanting the best for her boys, and then it also connects to me thinking about the episode that we did with Cynthia Clark, who talked about her husband dying and the experiences that their family had with MAID and the work, I'm going to call it work, but the amazing parenting that she did in terms of keeping conversations open with her children and trying to normalize and socialize that
not only for her own family, but the other young people who were associated. And that idea of, you know, letting her friends know, I'm paraphrasing, and Cynthia does this so well. She says, if you want your kids to see somebody who's died, come check out my husband because he looks pretty good for a dead guy. And to me, that was such an important conversation to have, but a really difficult one as well. And knowing also, too, how that might be heard from some people, because there have been a couple of instances where talking to children around medical assistance in dying has been seen in a really negative light. And Cynthia's conversation and efforts to take care of her children, herself, and her husband during that time were so heartfelt that I wanted to make sure that that was done in a great way. And it turned out, of course, I didn't need to worry because Cynthia knew exactly what she was doing and how to have that conversation. And I know I heard from many people how important that conversation was for them to hear.
Yeah, and I'll just say for our listeners, we have the stats on our end, and Cynthia's episode was the most popular. And that's the thing about quantitative stats, which is what we're getting, you know, from our podcasting platform. I wish I knew why, like why that episode was the most far-reaching. And it makes me question, are people really needing more resources for talking with children about end of life?
I think so. And that's why it also connects well with Chelsea Petal's book, Pancakes with Nana, that we had the chance to hear from her about as well, which has now been published, I'm excited to say. So if people are looking for resources, Chelsea Petal's book is geared towards having the conversation with children about MAID.
We've had a lot of fantastic guests on the podcast over the past year. However, despite our best efforts to bring diversity to our lineup, the majority of our guests have been white women specifically. Can you both talk a little bit about why you might think this is?
I think that that's a fascinating question. I think it in part getting going. Like, we just basically started a podcast as two researchers who knew a few people but didn't have any street cred in terms of doing a podcast. And I think we're beginning to move in that direction. And so initially we asked a couple of people who we felt would say yes. I think white women, in part because it is women who are doing most of the caregiving still at the end of life. Let's be honest around that. I think women do the majority of the heavy lifting around death work, if we're going to say around that. And I think we, as women, have had those conversations potentially a little bit more open, potentially. I also struggle with finding diversity in the research that I do, to be honest. And with our first study, I could lean back and say, okay, well, the characteristics of the people who are participating in our research, it actually looks pretty much like the people who are accessing MAID. For a while, we know that the person who was accessing MAID tended to be around a 74-year-old white male who was from a high socioeconomic background, well-educated, and generally had cancer. So we were interviewing often the spouses of that white male who used MAID at the end of their life. And so that was kind of a bit of a starting off point for us in terms of what we were used to. And I think we need to have some more street cred in the podcast world to be able to find some more diversity. And we're very open to that. We finally had a solo male guest, Dr. Jeff Myers, who I have to say was one of my favorite interviews, personally because I enjoy talking to Jeff whenever given the opportunity. But also it felt hopeful to me in terms of what's being done to improve the knowledge and education of future healthcare providers in regards to serious illness conversations, not specifically around medical assistance in dying, but the importance of those conversations.
I want to echo what Kathy has said. Certainly, I think the people with whom we've had a chance to talk really are quite reflective of the population. You know, you only have to go to the Hospice Palliative Care Conference of Ontario, and it's a sea of women. However, I think also, too, I just want to, again, I'm always looking through an education lens, and I think it's the same when we talk about the social determinants of health. We're talking about people, certainly when we talk about social determinants of education, kids who are in socioeconomically challenged parts of Ontario certainly in a lot of ways are really eking out an education experience. I think it's very true for people who are socioeconomically challenged in terms of their health care as well. So I think, while I don't think MAID is, you know, the maraschino cherry on the top of the cake, what I'm trying to get at is I think a lot of the times, even MAID coming into the conversation in a lot of spaces, there's a certain amount of privilege that that brings into the space. And I think nascent legislation like MAID, perhaps we'll start to see it evolve so that it does start to. I'm seeing more and more healthcare assessors and providers who are BIPOC, who are Black, Indigenous, people of color, et cetera. I think that is changing. Perhaps evolution will show diversity in a lot of other ways. But right now, I completely agree with Kathy that our podcast and its guests are reflective of who gets to be involved in MAID.
And I think it's changing. The people who are accessing MAID is changing. And I hope that we will also see more diversity reflected in our guests moving forward. And so we're working on that, listeners. Please know we are. And if you want to give us suggestions of who we could be talking to, again, don't hesitate. We're very open to that.
I intentionally put that question in there so that we can clarify why our lineup has looked the way it has. So thank you for clarifying that for our listeners. Because I think one of the very first conversations we had was how we want this podcast to be diverse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this has been a truly enlightening conversation for me, and I hope our listeners have enjoyed it as well, getting to know the two of you a little bit more and hearing us reflect on the past year of the podcast. So Kathy, Carrie, how about I let the two of you lead us out with an outro and I'll get to editing.
All right. That's Sadie. You know, she puts together a mean podcast. We are very lucky to have her, but she asked some tricky questions.
They were. And what I love about it too, again, looking through an educator lens, you know, talking about the work that we do and how we do it, and then going and doing it, hopefully will make us better and more aware of what we get to do every month. So fantastic.
And so thanks, listeners. Can't believe it's been 12 episodes. Carolyn, I'm looking forward to next year, and we will keep those conversations going.
Stories me.